From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
Good morning. I'm John Wells, filling in for Chris Cherniak today until he returns at the end of the month.
Well, we've talked a lot about a widely used class of pesticides called neonicotinoids before, in the context of their impacts on honeybees and native pollinators, and even their role in the decline of the monarch butterfly. But today we'll be speaking with Cynthia Palmer, Director of Pesticide Science and Regulation at the American Bird Conservancy, about the heavy impact of these chemicals on birds.
The EPA has just released their risk assessment report on four neonicotinoids, and Cynthia will share her thoughts on it as well as how listeners can provide feedback.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll be talking about an iconic bird of the American West, the greater sage grouse. The population of this species is down 97% from historic levels, with habitat loss also happening at a quick clip.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service declined to protect greater sage grouse under the Endangered Species Act in 2015, citing an unprecedented range-wide effort by federal agencies and states to conserve the bird, but at the same time, the Endangered Species Coalition just listed it as one of the top 10 species to protect for the incoming administration. We're going to be talking with Allison Jones, the executive director of the Wild Utah Project, about sage-grouse conservation and the future of this species.
Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay tuned.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Hi, this is Brenda with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage collection, and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Thank you for helping to keep Summit County clean and green. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that is JW across the board this morning. And joining us for the first half of the show is Cynthia Palmer, the Director of Pesticide Science and Regulation at the American Bird Conservancy. Cynthia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with just a quick overview of what the American Bird Conservancy is. Tell us about your organization.
American Bird Conservancy is an organization that seeks to protect native birds and their habitats throughout the Americas. And we use sound science to halt extinctions, protect habitats, eliminate threats, and build capacity for bird conservation. We address a number of different threats. I work with the pesticides program, but we also have several others, including a program on glass, because many birds, about $1 billion a year, die from collisions with glass, and yet there are ways to treat glass, for example, with hidden patterns, so that birds actually can see the glass, even though we can't see the hidden patterns inside the glass. We have a program to keep your cats indoors. That is, cats kill about 2.5 billion birds each year. We have programs on communication towers. For example, the lights that you see on the power transmission towers, they disorient the birds, and they're a cause for collisions. And there's a simple fix, which is instead of having steady lights, if the lights are flashing, then that will save huge numbers of birds just by using the strobe instead of the steady state of lights. So those are some of our programs, but we have, you know, a full range looking at habitats and other issues.
Well, as you said, yeah, there's a huge broad range that you guys cover and great resources on your website. And today we're obviously focusing on the impact of some pesticides on birds and specifically looking at neonics or neonicotinoids. Tell us about what these pesticides are.
So these are a class of insecticides that were first introduced in the U.S. in 1994, and they quickly became the most widely used insecticides on Earth. They're neurotoxins. They cause paralysis, and they interfere with bird flight, often at very low doses, and they kill a range of invertebrates, including the bees, but also they kill birds and other organisms. And they're very persistent in the soils. They're systemic throughout the plant, so the whole plant becomes toxic, and they're water soluble. They readily get into our water supplies.
Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you, inside the Beltway tomorrow morning, House Democrats and Republicans will have their first look at Scott Pruitt, who is President-elect Trump's nominee to head the U.S. EPA. And he's made some questionable claims related to global warming, fracking, and the Clean Power Plan. He even describes himself as the leading advocate against EPA's activist agenda. What are your thoughts on him as a candidate?
We are very concerned. At least speaking personally, I'm so nervous. This man spent his career suing the EPA, dismantling regulations to protect clean air and water. He has been funded by the dirtiest of industries, and his job will be to do their bidding in D.C. So personally, I'm very concerned.
Yeah, as Oklahoma's attorney general since 2011, he has repeatedly sued the EPA and other government entities over environmental rules and regulations, and oftentimes in direct cooperation with fossil fuel companies. It's going to be a fascinating conversation.
Yes, indeed. We will all be watching.
So speaking of the EPA, along those lines, EPA just released their preliminary risk assessment on four of these different neonics, four of these different insecticides. And, you know, the American Bird Conservancy came out saying this doesn't even address impacts on birds. So tell us a little bit about what this preliminary risk assessment looks like and what it is focusing on, if not birds.
Right. At the end of last week, EPA released several preliminary risk assessments on one of them on aquatic invertebrates and the others on risks to bees. And they did find some risks from certain applications, especially from risks on when these pesticides are used on cotton, on berries, on cucumbers. They did find some risks, and they certainly found risks to aquatic invertebrates. At the very same time, they issued a guidance document that actually reversed course and backed away from a proposed rule to restrict the neonicotinoid pesticides when commercial honeybees are present in a field. So beekeepers and environmentalists generally have been very concerned about these proposed voluntary guidelines. They impose no mandatory use restrictions, and we feel it's actually reversing course, despite the fact that on the very same day, EPA issued these risk assessments saying that there is harm to bees and to birds. The risk assessments themselves are, as you alluded to, they're rather limited in scope. They don't look at coated seeds, for example, which are used on over 100 million acres, including on alfalfa. They don't look at non-agricultural uses, even though neonics are widely present in home and garden products. And they fail to evaluate other species, including birds. There's also, we were hoping for a cumulative risk assessment because oftentimes these neonic products are used together. And in fact, American Bird Conservancy did a study last year. We went to the congressional dining halls and to the House and the Senate, and we tested the food that the congressmen eat. And we took 66 samples, and in 60 of them, or 91%, contained neonicotinoids in the food. And more than half of the samples, actually 71%, contained two or more neonicotinoids, and some products contained as much as five neonics per sample. The fresh squeezed orange juice, the bell peppers, they had five neonics in a single bite of food. And this is what the Congress eats. This is like really good food too. So so we wanted EPA to do a cumulative risk assessment, looking at what are the impacts if you use all these neonics together, not just one. And in practice, they're used alongside fungicides and other pesticides, so it's even worse than that.
So was the American Bird Conservancy surprised to find that 71% of this food was contaminated with these chemicals?
Yeah, it was 91% of the food that the congressmen eat contained the neonics. 71% was foods with two or more neonics. So that's the whole reason we want to see a cumulative risk assessment. We want to see what happens when you add them all together, not just one little pesticide per bite, because that's in practice they're used like multiple pesticides at the same time.
And do you think this is representative of what the general population is eating? Are we all eating a good amount of neonicotinoids every day?
Yeah, I think we are. The House and Senate cafeterias are run by a food service company that is committed to sustainability and emphasizes organic food. So I actually think that what the senators are eating is probably better than what the rest of us are eating. So yes, we have a full menu of neonics in every bite, unfortunately.
I was curious as to how popular these neonicotinoids were, and the four that you mentioned in your press release on January 13th, I looked up on Amazon, and you can buy all four in a number of different configurations. You can buy it at 100% strength. You can buy it at 20% strength, mixed in with this and mixed in with that. Some of them are found in very, very popular weed control type products from major players, and all of them are available for prime shipping. So when you say 100 million acres of cropland that you have for agriculture, there's a whole bunch of this stuff that is being sold to individuals to deal with their own gardens.
Absolutely. There was a report by Friends of the Earth a few months ago that found that over half of the garden plants purchased at top garden retailers in 18 cities in the U.S. and Canada contain the neonic pesticides. So they are widely used in home and garden products, but also in the plants that you buy. And also they're in extremely high concentrations in veterinary products. So if anyone has a cat or a dog and treats them, they are bringing large concentrations of of neonics into their home. So it's just like you say, they're found, these neonics are found most everywhere in the pest control sector, and they have become a one-size-fits-all approach to pest management. And as a mom of adolescent girls, I know that one-size-fits-all is really one-size-fits-none. In this case, they are wreaking havoc on entire ecosystems, and they're killing the diverse wildlife that pollinates our crops and that controls our pests for free.
You know, Cynthia, I'm curious. It's my sense, and I could be wrong about this, but it's my sense that for a number of different things, Europe and Canada seem to be on the leading edge, and they're in front of these things before we even know about them. Why is that? Oh, first of all, is my sense correct?
Yes. Unfortunately, it is. The European Union placed a moratorium on several of the neonics on the attractive crops in 2013. The province of Ontario, Canada, has restricted the use because of their connection with the large-scale disappearance of pollinators. And now all of Canada has a proposal to ban the neonics because they are found so they're so widespread in the groundwater, and Canada is concerned that they are affecting invertebrates, which are the basis for all other organisms.
I want to circle back a little bit to the coated seeds that you mentioned for crops such as alfalfa. And I think I read that you all did a study and concluded that for a songbird, ingesting a single one of these seeds could actually be lethal. So talk a little bit about, you know, how this works, what these, you know, how these seeds are coated, and how they're used in the field.
Sure. So the neonics, like we said, they're used to coat the seeds on hundreds of millions of acres of commodity crops like corn, soybeans, cotton, canola, sunflowers. When I first heard about seed treatments, I thought, wow, that's a great idea because it's very efficient. It really targets just the seed, and you know, you don't have all the other contamination issues. And I was completely wrong. In reality, about 90 to 95% of the neonics sloughs off the seed, into the air, into the groundwater, and contaminates a wide range of environments. An American Bird Conservancy, since we're very concerned about birds, obviously, we did a study, well, a review. We looked at 200 studies and 2,800 pages of industry research we obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, and we found that neonics are indeed lethal to birds, and that a single kernel of corn coated with a neonic can kill a songbird, and as little as a tenth of a coated seed each day during the egg-laying season can impair reproduction. So the neonics are very, very toxic to birds in their direct form, and we also looked at aquatic insects, which are critical to the swifts, swallows, and other insect-eating birds, and whose populations are now in decline, and we found that the levels of the neonic chemicals in many surface and groundwaters are already high enough to kill these aquatic invertebrates on which so many of the birds depend. So so it's very worrisome in terms of impacts for the birds.
So with all of that in mind, do you have, you know, an estimate of a number of birds impacted? I know when you were talking about some of the other, you know, like the glass strikes or the radio towers, you had some estimates of roughly, you know, how these are impacting bird populations. Do you have any guess in this area?
Right. I wish that we had the numbers. There's research in Oklahoma now trying to put a number on, you know, on just how many bird deaths, and we don't know. We know that the birds are extremely sensitive. There's a lot of, you know, focus on the bees, and yet the birds, the earthworms, the monarch butterflies, and quite possibly even the bats are affected by the neonics. So it would be great to get, you know, some quantitative data on exactly how many, but we don't know that yet.
If you're just joining us on This Green Earth, Nell and I are having a conversation with Cynthia Palmer, who is the Director of Pesticide Science and Regulation for ABC, which is an acronym that stands for the American Bird Conservancy. Cynthia, can you tell us about ABC? Is this a nonprofit for folks that would like to maybe get involved in doing some volunteer work or sending some money your way? How would they get in touch with you? Tell us a bit about your organization.
Sure. ABC, American Bird Conservancy, is based in Washington, D.C. and Virginia, with offices around the country and also in Latin America. And we are a nonprofit. We have a single and steadfast commitment to protecting native birds and their habitats. And you can find us at abcbirds.org.
Okay. And do you have volunteer opportunities? What sort of things, what sort of resources do you need to do your job?
We work with many other organizations, which often, you know, we have projects that involve volunteers. And I mean, I think our main need, like all organizations, is just, you know, money to do the studies and carry out the habitat protection work. But there are, you know, there are all sorts of ways to get involved, and there are we have a whole section on our website with action alerts and things that people can do to try and make their voices heard on behalf of birds.
I'm glad you mentioned your website, because I think it is a great resource. There's a section on threats that lists some that might even surprise people, like fisheries or general lack of resources, as well as solutions, and then how to get involved on all of these different fronts. You mentioned a few threats at the beginning of the show, like the bird strikes into windows or like cats and invasive species. But how do you address something like climate change? That's such a huge issue.
Yeah, I wish I could answer that in a real forceful way, that I have the solution for
climate change.
Cynthia,
she asks me tough questions all the time. Don't feel picked on.
Okay. I mean, we try to address that one on so many fronts, including such things as relocating certain bird colonies in Hawaii that will be underwater soon if we don't relocate the birds to higher ground. But here in D.C., we engage in the political process more directly, and in the coming months, obviously, we will have much more to do to try and fight for, you know, the strongest possible climate regulations that we can.
Well, we have to wrap up in just a minute or two here, but I wanted to ask, is there a, you know, you mentioned that the EPA just released their risk assessments for these neonics. Is there a way that people can weigh in or provide feedback on this?
There is. There is a 60-day comment period, and they are, so EPA is accepting comments from citizens as well as organizations of various sorts, and the dockets for these chemicals are available at www.regulations.gov. Sometimes they're a little tricky to find. The names of the chemicals might help if you type in the words imidacloprid, clothianidin, thiamethoxam, dinotefuran. That might help. But you can also just write to me directly at abcbirds.org, and I will send people in the right direction.
Fantastic. Well, it's really exciting to see all of the solution-oriented work that the American Bird Conservancy is doing. Cynthia Palmer, the Director of Pesticide Science and Regulation at the American Bird Conservancy, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks to Cynthia for a great spot. And now we're going to take a quick break for a few underwriters, and we'll be back for the second half of the show. We'll be talking about sage-grouse conservation in the West with Allison Jones, the Executive Director of the Wild Utah Project. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve Celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, this is Katie from Recycle Utah. Did you know that Recycle Utah collected and recycled 735 tons of glass last year? You are able to recycle any color glass, green, brown, blue, and clear at the recycling center or in one of Recycle Utah's 4 remote glass recycling bins.
Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for now 25 years. We support KPCW and the idea of leading sustainable lives in Park City.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that is JW across the board this morning. And during the second half of the show today, we are going to be talking about an iconic bird of the American West, the greater sage grouse. We'll be speaking with Allison Jones, the Executive Director of the Wild Utah Project. Allison, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You bet. Happy to be here.
So let's start by talking just a little bit about the Wild Utah Project. We'll dig in a little bit later, but tell us about your organization.
Sure. We're a nonprofit conservation group. We bring science-based strategies for public lands management and wildlife management and conservation in Utah. And we work an awful lot with the nonprofit conservation community. We work as sort of a contractor and a partner with them, helping to bring science to their conservation campaigns, ranging from wilderness campaigns to bringing about better wildlife management on our public lands, the things that fit Wild Utah Project's mission.
Fantastic. So since we're focusing on the sage grouse today, let's start with a profile of this bird, because they're beautiful, but they're also kind of a goofy bird for listeners that may not know what they're like. So describe this bird to us, you know, what they look like, where do they live, that kind of thing.
You bet. They can be kind of a goofy bird. They're about the size of a chicken. They blend in to the sagebrush. They're nicely camouflaged. Males are a little bigger than females, and I think they get the goofy reputation because of their mating displays on the leks. Leks are the gathering grounds where they come together to mate, and basically the males put on quite a show for the females, spreading out those tail feathers, and they have these chest sacks on their chest that they blow up with air like big yellow balloons and then deflate them with this crazy noise. Anyone listening, just go to YouTube, Google it. It's one of the strangest things you ever saw, but it works. The female birds come running to the mating grounds. They're just a really cool bird.
My friend Robbie Schumacher got me up at 4 o'clock in the morning once, and we drove out by Snow Basin to one of the Lekses to mm-hmm. witness this firsthand. It was like, by the time we got out there, it was about 5:30 in the morning. Sun was just coming up. And I got to believe that Mick Jagger has completely grabbed this thing for his persona, because I saw about five or six different Mick Jaggers out there dancing.
That's right, exactly. And you do have to get up mighty early, but it is worth it. And yeah. Wild Utah Project takes groups to go see local leks in the spring as well. So it's good times.
So what's at stake here? We're not just talking about the sage grouse, but we're talking about the sagebrush grasslands and a number of different species that are involved. Can you talk about that?
That's right. The sage grouse is found in any part of the western U.S. where we have intact stands of the sagebrush ecosystem. And so this covers millions and millions of acres across a big chunk of Nevada and southeast Oregon through Utah, the Great Basin Desert, and parts of the Colorado Plateau, most of southern Idaho, and pretty much all of Wyoming and big chunks of Montana as well. So this is a huge ecosystem. It represents hundreds of other species, ranging from lizards to a sagebrush-dependent songbirds, things like the sage thrasher, the sage sparrow, brewer's sparrow, and dozens and scores of others, mammals as well. So they're an indicator species, basically, for this huge ecosystem. If the sage grouse is doing well out there in the sagebrush sea, a myriad of other species are going to be doing okay as well.
Well, with that in mind, how are they doing right now? Let's talk about the population trends.
You bet. And so the interesting thing about the sage grouse is that the populations, they tend to trend together, not just across Utah, but across the range. They have these decadal or 10-year patterns of ups and downs. Right now, we're just coming out of an up cycle, starting to plateau in Utah and elsewhere. And so right now, the numbers are probably around, across these 11 western states, 425 to 500,000 birds. And that might sound like a lot, but the estimates are back in the 1800s, when the settlers and pioneers were coming across the West, the estimates are 16 million back then. So even though 450,000 sounds like a lot of birds, this is only 2 or 3% of what it was. In Utah, we're probably right around the state's goal of about 4,500 to maybe even 5,000 birds. That's our share of the pie, so to speak. And like I said, we're coming out of the last pattern of an upswing. However, when you look at the long-term trends over the past, however you break it up, 15, 30, 60 years, as long as the records have been kept, and you average out the population over that time, we are still on a downward trend as of today.
So with that in mind, how do you manage something like this? How do you make a decision about what kind of protection they need? I bring that up specifically because there's been obviously a lot of talk with this bird about whether it's worth listing on the endangered, or whether it's, appropriate for listing on the endangered species list.
Right. So, yeah, there's been a lot of attention on this species and that question. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is the agency in charge of deciding whether to put the species under the Endangered Species Act or not, they did conclusively decide in 2010 that, yes, this species is warranted for listing. They were looking at those long-term, again, 20, 40, whoever you slice it, patterns of downward trends across the range of the species over all those decades, also looking at the threats to the birds. We can get more into that, but they're significant. And so after the Fish and Wildlife Service decided, yes, it is warranted to list, then the states and the agencies, the federal land management agencies, I'm talking about the Bureau of Land Management or on the BLM lands and the U.S. Forest Service with the Forest Service lands, they kicked into high gear to come up with new and better land management conservation plans to thwart listing, to keep the species from being listed. And the states all put together their own conservation plans, and Utah did as well, and we can talk more about that. But significantly, the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service amended 99 land use plans across the range of the bird, doing backflips, you know, to put in better protections for the species. That's how the listing was avoided. The Fish and Wildlife Service had given warning to the agencies. They said, these new management plans have to pass muster with us, and if they do, we can avoid a listing. Apparently, the two agencies did a good enough job, and the listing was avoided in 2015. They kept it off the list.
And do you see this as enough? Is this protective enough of this species? And how would it differ from the protections under an endangered species listing?
So if the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't agree and had gone ahead and list, I honestly think that it wouldn't be that much different on paper. I mean, basically what the new plans are doing are kind of drawing circles around LECs, and the closer you get to the LEC, the more off-limit it is to do new oil and gas drilling or other developments and that sort of thing. There's also kind of a threshold of over an entire management area, how much development would be allowed. There's a 3% threshold. And so on paper, those things wouldn't have changed very much, I think. The difference is with these new land use plan revisions, there might be a little more wiggle room, some cases where they can make exceptions to things. And so we really need to carefully watch if the promises that have been made on paper across all these public lands in these different states are kept. You know, how much wiggle room is there? How many new oil and gas developments do they allow? How close to these LECs? What percent of land disturbance do they allow in, you know, a core area or a sage-grouse management area? So it's all sounding pretty good on paper, and the conservation groups who watch the sage-grouse, some of the big ones, they're watching very, very closely to see that these promises are kept.
Allison, in addition to fracking and drilling, what are the other risks to the greater sage-grouse?
So the risks are very different in different parts of the range. So in the eastern part of the range, Montana, Wyoming, the Uinta Basin, for example, the threats there, you just named them. It is the fracking, the coal bed methane, oil and gas, all the roads that go with those developments. Those are the big ones. In the western part of the range, and this is going to be Oregon, Nevada, Utah's West Desert, parts of Idaho, it's a different problem here. That problem is a fire cycle that's totally out of whack because of the invasive exotic cheatgrass that's taking over. The cheatgrass comes in, it burns, the sagebrush is burning way more often than it used to. Historically, these places would burn every, you know, 100, 150 years, maybe more in some cases. And the whole place goes up in smoke with the sagebrush with it. You lose the sagebrush. What comes back first? The cheatgrass. It is a terrible, vicious cycle. That's what the sage-grouse is really up against in the western part of the range.
Cheatgrass. How do you spell that?
Cheat. Like it cheats, like on a test, C-A-E-A-T. Okay. So it gets out in front of everything else after a fire, like it's cheating.
So sage burns, it used to be 100 to 150 years. What sort of cycle are, well, it's probably random, but what's the average of the cycle now of these burns?
I'm not an expert on the new fire cycle. I think it depends on state, but I wouldn't be surprised if someone told me in Nevada that the sagebrush is burning, you know, every 10 to 20 years now. I mean, it's scary.
So as far as management goes of the, you know, conservation of the greater sage grouse, how do you expect this to be impacted by the incoming administration over the next 4 years? Do you expect to see it change drastically, or because the states are so involved, do you think it'll sort of stay status quo?
You know, I'm sure hoping for status quo. We need to give these new land use plan amendments on the BLM and Forest Service lands a chance to work, to prove that we can recover this species without the Endangered Species Act, but they have to be left in place. There's currently talk of meddling with this in D.C. No big surprise. I think many in Utah, including our legislature and some of our representatives and Rob Bishop, would be very happy to see the agencies throw out these management plan amendments. And the agencies won't do it. It would have to be an act of Congress, basically, turning over these management plan amendments. And it's just hard to imagine, because remember, pretty much the entire decision to keep the species off the list was because of these management plans. If you throw them out, the service would almost be forced to list the species, which is exactly what the states don't want. So I hope that cool heads prevail. I hope some of these scary-sounding bills and riders that they're talking about in D.C. that would undo these amendments, I hope clear heads prevail. It gets, you know, stopped in the Senate. Lots of bad things during the Obama administration in terms of anti-environmental riders definitely got stopped in the Senate. And so I'm just hoping for the best. But Utah also pays for a lobbyist through our legislature that's working to undo these plans as well, which is super unfortunate. So I'm just hoping clear heads prevail in D.C.
Allison, as you look at all of this, well, for our listeners that would like to have, you know, get more information on the sage grouse and the programs and everything that you all have done, what are the best resources for them?
Oh, well, folks can always go to the Wild Utah Project website, www.wildutahproject.org. We're in the midst of overhauling it, so we're rolling that out soon. Very exciting. There's some great larger regional and nationwide environmental groups who really track the sage-grouse issue. Defenders of Wildlife is one of them, the Center for Biological Diversity, Western Watersheds Project. These are the bigger green groups, really have their finger on the pulse of this species. They have folks in D.C. working on it there. Yeah.
Okay. And what are their, let's take a few minutes to talk about Wild Utah Project. So sage grouse is obviously one of the wildlife species you're focusing on, but I know you're doing a lot of other work. Will you take a few minutes and talk about some of the other projects that you're focusing on and also mention if there's opportunity for listeners to get involved?
Absolutely. At Wild Utah Project, we do a lot of citizen science, and including citizen science that involves sage grouse habitat assessments. This coming season, we're going to be really focused on beaver issues and beaver reintroductions. We'll be having a citizen science group down in the Sheep Rocks, the Sheep Rock Mountains, doing a pre-beaver habitat assessment of Vernon Creek, which is very degraded. And then after we do our habitat assessments, that's the pre-treatment data, basically. And we're going to be working with Utah Division of Wildlife Resources and other partners to put in these beaver dam analogs, which is the precursor to the beaver dam. It's basically, it helps make a man-made beaver dam for the beavers to start with. And then eventually we bring in the actual beavers to maintain the new dams. It's pretty neat stuff. We also will be doing our fourth annual boreal toad surveys and amphibian habitat bioblitz in Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons. This is a partnership with the U.S. Forest Service and Division of Wildlife Resources. We're collecting information on, well, where the boreal toads might still be clinging on in the central Wasatch, and also which sites might be appropriate for repatriation or reintroduction of boreal toads. So folks can get involved with that. We'll also be doing some bat surveys this summer within the Salt Lake Valley and some of the open spaces and parks, where we'll be working with the county on bat box placement and monitoring the use of bat boxes. So definitely some fun citizen science opportunities with Wild Utah Project this summer, and folks can check those out on our website soon. We're getting everything loaded on the website now for these opportunities.
Well, you learn something every day, and I never knew about cheatgrass before, but I would point to a PDF, which is Cheatgrass, the Invader That Won the West. There's pictures of the grasses. There's information on how invasive this is. This originally came from Europe and Asia. How did it get here? And it's really taken off.
Oh, I know. How does all that stuff get here? I think some of it gets tacked on to bags of grain that come overseas. It sounds like the cheatgrass first appeared here way back in the late 1800s. It could come on livestock that's transported. So many bad invasive species have come from abroad through our shipping. There's so many different avenues it could come in.
Cheatgrass is a show all in itself, John, I think, right? We'll have to do a whole nother show on that with you.
She's bringing me along.
Oh, yeah.
She's educating me, Allison.
Yeah. You could do a couple shows. It's pretty bad news, and climate change not helping, unfortunately.
Well,
I don't want to end on a sour note. But
yeah, well, you guys are doing lots of great things and making a big difference in the state. Just once again, where can people reach you if they want to get involved?
www.wildutahproject.org.
Fantastic. That is Allison Jones, the executive director of the Wild Utah Project. Allison, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and we'll be in touch.
You bet. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. We are going to take a quick break for a couple more underwriters, and then we'll be back to give a quick preview of our special show this Friday, where we'll be focusing on the environmental films coming into Sundance. Stay tuned.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440.
Support for KPCW is provided by Sundance Institute, a nonprofit organization. The Sundance Film Festival is proud to call Utah home, with screenings this January 19th through January 29th in Park City, Salt Lake City, and Sundance Resort. The festival's home state is as important to its identity as its filmmakers. Don't miss the world premieres of the best in independent film, along with live music, virtual reality, panel discussions, and more. More information at sundance.org/locals.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
And we're having a little trouble with our theme music. Well, now I guess we're not going to have theme music.
Well, I could start singing if we want, but...
Well, a little problem with that pot there. Okay.
Sounds good. Well, as our listeners may know, each year we're lucky enough to get to do a Sundance special, and it's sponsored by Whole Foods. And so the show is broadcast live from Whole Foods. We'll be sitting back in the sort of the deli area where you can order your coffee and things along those lines. And we'll be doing an environmental special, talking to several of the environmental documentaries that are going to be debuting at Sundance.
It's fascinating. And this is the first year that Sundance has a theme. All of these years, and they have a theme.
I know. What does that tell us? It must be an important one.
It must be an important one.
They're calling it the new climate.
The new climate.
This year. And so we'll be talking with some of the folks involved with that. We should also mention that on Friday, if you happen to do your shopping at Whole Foods, 5% of what you spend is donated to KPCW.
That's right.
So, you know, save up your big expensive purchases for Friday so KPCW can benefit from all of that. But let's talk about a few of the films that we're going to be seeing or that we're going to be speaking with. I think one that we are all hearing a lot about is An Inconvenient Sequel, of course. This is the follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's film that has been so popular over the years. And we'll be speaking with Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck, who are the directors of that film.
Yeah, and Al Gore may stop by. We've asked him. We don't know if he's going to be able to or not. But he is going to be at the premiere, which is Thursday the 19th. And he will also be part of the festival's Power of Story panel, which is a collaboration between Sundance and the Redford Center. So that should be pretty interesting.
Yeah, cross your fingers that, you know, Al Gore stops by. That'll make our morning. Another one that we'll be looking at is a film called Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. And we actually interviewed the author of this book a few months back, so listeners might remember that. It's really kind of a story of families who work the land there, as the title goes, ranchers, farmers, and fishermen. And they really cross the political divide when it comes to environmental issues. And it's, you know, there aren't many environmental documentaries out there that I think have the potential to make you leave feeling really good and warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
And this might be one of those.
And it's not just one family. It's a number of families from the Montana Rockies to the wheat fields of Kansas and the Gulf of Mexico, that families that work land and sea and are crossing political divides to find unexpected ways to protect the natural resources in their areas.
Yeah, people kind of taking action on a grassroots scale, not because they're tree huggers, but because they kind of see a different future.
Is the author involved in the documentary, the author of the book?
She is. She's also interviewed in the documentary, so okay. we'll get to see her make an appearance. I also want to mention Plastic China. This is a documentary of those who handle the materials that are specifically the plastic materials that are sent to China to get recycled. And I have to say, JW and I have seen a screener of this, and it's a pretty serious issue. It's some tough content, I think, to watch.
Yeah.
I think we imagine our recycling going to a clean facility and being melted down and easily repurposed, but it's far from a straightforward solution on the recycling front. A really eye-opening film.
And there's a number of moving pieces to this film. Jay is an 11-year-old girl who works alongside her parents in this recycling facility, and she's dreaming, of course, of attending school, but she's working all the time. Kun, who is the facility's foreman, he dreams of a better life. So it's through their eyes in a tough working situation. And I'm looking forward to speaking with those folks.
Yeah, suffice it to say, we all will think twice about where plastic recycling goes from here on out. We may need to start wrapping up now.
That's right.
Time flies.
I tell you what, while we will return right after this message. You're listening to KPCW in Park City. Stay with us.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Well, before we wrap up, we want to thank our underwriters today, who include Republic Services, Recycle Utah, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, Mark Miller Subaru, and of course, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, and San Francisco Design.
And once again, everyone come on out on Friday and do some purchasing at Whole Foods. 5% of your purchase will go towards us. We want to thank you all for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. Beautiful day out there. Everybody get out there and have some fun. NPR, National News.